Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on chemical dependency.
Good morning. Today we're going to be talking about the harm reduction model, and we'll go over six questions that you can use that are especially useful in the outpatient setting to help identify people who might be at risk of problems with using opioids in the longer term. So we're going to talk about the DSM-5 symptoms used to diagnose substance use disorders. We'll talk about the difference between pseudo-addiction and addiction. And then we'll cover the six steps, or the steps in the harm reduction model, and identify six risk factors that predict future aberrant behaviors. So as you know, cancer pain affects a large percentage of the population. There's 17 million worldwide with cancer-related pain. There's about, 18 million cancer survivors, so a large percentage of them have experienced pain during that experience. 30 to 40% of those with pain are undergoing active treatment, and then 70 to 90% of patients with advanced disease. So a lot of the patients that we might see in palliative medicine will be experiencing some type of pain. And as you recall from some of our other talks, pain is associated with depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and financial distress. And in 2007, for the first time in Ohio, unintentional drug poisoning became the leading cause of injury-related deaths, surpassing motor vehicle accidents for the first time. And since then, we've kind of seen the same trend. From 1999 to 2009, this represented a 301% increase, driven primarily by prescription drug overdoses. In 2008 alone, there were 1,473 such deaths, or four per day. And I think that's only gradually increased with the opioid epidemic in Ohio. Pain medications are associated with more overdoses than any other prescription or illegal drug, including cocaine and heroin. So that's also changed over time. It used to be heroin overdoses. Opioids that are most commonly associated with overdoses are methadone, which you can guess why, just because of it building up in the system and maybe people not realizing the impact of taking more and more of it. OxyContin, fentanyl, transdermal, and Opana ER. In 2007, almost 27% of high school students had reported using a prescription drug without a doctor's prescription. So most often they're either getting into their parents' medicine cabinets or at a friend's house and experimenting, or another relative. So in order to manage pain well, it's a real balancing act. So from fear-driven pain management to fearless pain management. So we want to be somewhere in the middle. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. If you have high fear, you're going to risk under-treating pain. What you might hear from someone who's on this end of the spectrum is that patients are faking some or all of their pain symptoms to obtain pain medications. Providers might be more concerned about regulatory or legal actions. They might be concerned about over-sedation with pain medications or respiratory distress. And they might be worried about creating drug addicts. So, when those fears are allowed to drive decisions concerning pain management, patients suffer as a result of that. On the other hand, you have providers who have absolutely no fear, the super men and women of pain management, and there you might risk undertreating other comorbid conditions because everything appears as a physical pain problem. So you might miss substance abuse or psychiatric disorders. Here there's a belief that the undertreatment of pain is too common and opioid addiction is rare or non-existent. I see fewer with no fear these days just because of the opioid epidemic and more people on the high fear spectrum. But Russ Portnoy had a change of heart. He originally wrote some papers about cancer pain management and kind of had a shift in his way of thinking. He said, "I did that because I thought that in patients with chronic pain, these risks could be minimized, and that compared with the problem of undertreated pain, the concern about abuse, addiction, and diversion was not that relevant. Fast forward 10 years later, and we recognize that this was a big error. So we've got to be paying attention to both." And somewhere in the middle, so doctors should have two sets of skills to use these drugs safely and effectively, or they shouldn't use them, and that includes all providers. So those skills are prescribing opioids, which I think most physicians prescribing opioids or providers get a lot of training about how to prescribe and do morphine oral equivalents, but few actually get a lot of training in how to minimize the risk associated with abuse. So that's what we're going to be focused on this session and then the next session. So inappropriate treatment of pain, just keeping this in mind, includes non-treatment, under-treatment, over-treatment, and then continued use of ineffective treatment. So if you see a person who's just not responding, regardless of how far you're going up on a certain medication, being sure to scale that back and transition. So not keeping on a person that's reporting high levels of pain on the same medications and same doses. So we're going to cover a few definitions. So to get started, we're going to talk about tolerance, physical dependence, substance use disorder, and pseudo-addiction. Can anybody tell me what a definition of tolerance is?
No longer having the same physical effects with the same dose, meaning escalating doses.
Yeah, so as she said, needing to take more and more of the same dose to get the same effect. So the dose is no longer sufficient. So you think about someone maybe drinking a couple of beers or two or three beers, and it no longer has the same effect. So then they bump up to four or five beers to get that same effect. What about physical dependence? What's a key sign that somebody is has become physically dependent? What happens?
If they don't take the drug, they will you'll see physical manifestations like tremors or restlessness, agitation.
Yeah, in the absence of the drug, you start to see withdrawal effects. So that means the person has become physically dependent on the drug. We'll talk about the criteria for substance use disorder. That's a little bit different than just physical dependence. And then pseudo-addiction we'll also go over. These are the most common opioid withdrawal symptoms, so things to look out for if somebody's coming into clinic with a lot of these symptoms, maybe running out of their medications frequently and earlier than anticipated. So you might see sweating, rhinorrhea, so they might look like they have a cold, dilated pupils, piloerection. They may have tachycardia, nausea or vomiting, cramps, diarrhea, muscle aches and pain, and bone pain. And in terms of psychological or behavioral symptoms, they may do a lot of yawning, report anxiety or insomnia, be more restless or really irritable. So those are some things you can look out for in terms of withdrawal. The DSM 5 substance use criteria changed with the DSM-5. DSM-4, we had categorized people as experiencing substance abuse or substance dependence, and then that was really confusing, especially with regard to different drugs. So they've collapsed these into these 11 different criteria that we would look for to diagnose substance use disorder, and then you would rate that with the numbers on the bottom, so either no disorder, mild, moderate, and severe. When you get to severe, they're usually experiencing tolerance and withdrawal symptoms included in that. But some of these can be problematic, particularly for patients taking opioids. So I just want to point out the craving or a strong desire, urge to use pain medication. You're going to see that with someone on chronic opioids, because once they stop or decrease the dose by a certain amount, they may start to experience withdrawal symptoms. And those can be really unpleasant. So they're, of course, going to have craving to use more of that. So unless they're on a very slow wean, you might see increased craving. Another to watch out for, especially with our population of patients, continued use despite number 6, despite persistent or recurrent social or interpersonal problems caused or exacerbated by the effects of the substance. That's difficult to untangle with our patients because they're often not able to work or do their other activities of daily living just because of their disease status. So it may have very little to do with the drug that they're taking and more to do with just their functional status. So that's important to take into consideration. So as you can see, it can be kind of tricky to diagnose substance use disorder. And what we, what I typically will pay attention to is what is the person doing outside of coming into clinic and getting their medications? Are they trying to be active? Are they trying to do a bit more? Does the drug help them to be more functional, even if it's minimally more functional, especially if they're spending a lot of time in bed because of their disease? And then are they how much time are they actually spending trying to get more and more of the drug? Are they doctor shopping? Or are they running into problems where they're running out frequently? And are they sharing medications? Are they engaging in any kind of other illegal behavior? So there's several signs which we'll spend more time on in our next session on monitoring aberrant behaviors and what you can look for. Pseudo-addiction is the simplest definition is just under treatment of pain. It can look a lot like addiction, especially in the inpatient setting, because they're just watching the clock. It's time for my next dose, but what we're not seeing when we're not there is maybe that they're missing doses, or the nursing staff is just so busy with so many patients that they're not getting it right on schedule, so they may be running into end-of-dose failure. They may be moaning, clock watching, have repeated requests for medications, and they may actually have inadequate pain control, like if the drug has been scheduled for every 6 hours and it's actually running out of effect about after 4 hours, so that's important to consider. But it does, all these things improve with adequate analgesia. So when a provider with more expertise in pain management steps in and actually prescribes something that's helpful in not running into end of dose failure, you see all those signs disappear. There's a great article by Steve Pasek, and I think this was very helpful. We had multiple discussions among our team about, well, if a person is approaching the end of life, why does it matter? Why do we treat addiction? And I found his article to be really compelling. That's the title of it. So especially if someone is engaging in any type of cancer treatment. So it affects adherence to treatment. So they may miss appointments. Addiction limits social support available to help cope with a disease or treatment. Oftentimes when people are really addicted, especially to multiple drugs or alcohol, they can become more estranged from family members. So they may not have the greatest support system, which makes all of our work more difficult because then they tend to depend more on the medical system for support. Addiction is associated with depression, anxiety, and other psychological disorders. So I think there's sometimes this view that, oh, well, if it makes them happy and, you know, this is how they want to live their lives, it's okay. We're here to have them have a good quality of life. But most of the time, if somebody's spending all of their time, like kind of obsessively trying to get a drug and not focus on other things that may improve their quality of life, we're not really doing our job to help them have the best quality of life. So I say there's never a time, and that's my bias, to not address a person's addictive behaviors for the patient or for the family. So this is the harm reduction model. These are the steps. And so the initial part, which we'll talk about, is risk assessment, just like we would do with depression and suicidal ideation. We want to do a pretty thorough risk assessment to start out. Monitoring aberrant behaviors, documenting any aberrant behaviors that we're seeing so that we can monitor those over time, addressing the aberrant behaviors, and then aggressively treating any comorbidities. So we're going to walk through each of those steps. So starting with risk assessment. The goal of risk assessment is really not to say to a patient, oh, you have too many risk factors, so I'm not going to prescribe to you. So it's really to set an appropriate level of monitoring with the patient to increase the likelihood of a good clinical outcome for both the patient and the clinician and society. So we have to understand both controllable and uncontrollable risk factors. This is a great resource that I think probably one of the best things I read in terms of risk mitigation, this book by Webster and Dove, Avoiding Opioid Abuse While Treating Pain. I think it was really formative in understanding harm reduction for patients. So this says, but hey, it's not my fault. And actually, medication isn't the problem. Opioids may trigger or re-trigger addiction in individuals who exhibit vulnerabilities, but medications in and of themselves do not cause addiction. So we'll talk some more about that. This is one of the addiction models. I think we talked about biopsychosocial models to begin with, but these are all the factors that may go into whether somebody becomes addicted. So you have genetic risk, underlying vulnerabilities, psychological and social risk factors. So are they living in a home with someone else who's abusing drugs or other medications? Are they depressed? And then they have to be exposed, interact with the drug, and have a desirable interaction with that medication. In the middle, there's the premorbid addiction syndrome, combining all of these elements, and then they have repeated exposures to that drug or alcohol. And it can either express itself in any of those types of addiction, drinking, gambling, smoking, intravenous drug use. And some of the different manifestations or outcomes. So biologic outcomes, psychologic, and social outcomes, like we were talking about, being more estranged from the family, just not focused on taking care of the family because the ultimate focus becomes getting more and more of the drug. So Really, it's not just about the drug. You put the drug in a certain set of circumstances, and then you have a resulting addiction. So some of the risk factors that we look for are drug use history. So do they have any history of abusing prescription drugs? And interestingly, that in the study I'll talk about, that was not the top predictor of whether they would have problems abusing opioids. More cocaine or heroin abuse in the past was more predictive. Alcohol abuse, lack of drug treatment or follow-up. So you could have someone who comes in who, say, has a prescription drug use history, but then say they were in a treatment program for 6 months, and then they had 6 months of outpatient follow-up, and then they have a sponsor, and they're doing quite well. They may do just fine with opioid medications. But then you have someone that says, oh, I've never been in treatment and I don't want to try it. That's not going to work. I don't believe in the AA model. They may have more more difficulty managing their medication, so you might want to watch closely. Having a legal history, we'll talk more about that. That's really important. Who are they living with? Is there a family history of drug abuse? And that can go either way. I'd say that's a 50-50. I know that that's one of the first things you might read about when you're learning about addiction, but you have some people, you know, about half of the people with addiction who had such a horrible experience with it that no matter their genetic vulnerability, they say, no, I'm not even touching that stuff. I'm not going to go near it. So you have someone who may be abstinent completely from any type of alcohol or drugs. And then on the other hand, the genetic vulnerability and just observed behaviors may win out. Pre-adolescent sexual abuse, especially for females, I don't think that's so much a risk factor for males, but it is for females. Having a psychiatric diagnosis, especially impulse control disorders, so ADHD, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, and I definitely can attest to that I've seen that numerous times. Just I think it does something to calm down the impulsive element of those disorders. Depression, anxiety, suicide attempts, frequent accidents or injuries, started to understand that more about 3 or 4 years into practice. Just when drug use starts to become more problematic, you start getting more reports that they've been in car accidents, or they start to have falls, or just all kinds of wacky things happening that you want to watch out for. And then some of the protective factors just aren't there. Lack of social support, lack of any kind of meaningful hobbies, and then no religious or spiritual orientation. So just like we did with suicide risk management, we want to do a risk stratification. So based on the number of risk factors that person might be displaying. So is this a low-risk patient, a moderate risk or high risk patient? This is another paper you should check out, the Gourlay. It talks about universal precautions. So whenever you're seeing someone for the first time, you don't want to make promises that you can't keep. So talking with patients about having an opioid trial, or just we're gonna see how this works, and at some point we may have to stop this if it's ineffective or you're not responding well to the pain medications. Keeping in mind that even if a person is moderate or high risk, that vulnerability is not a certainty. They may be able to go on and manage their medications very well. And the person may change risk categories over time. So say they're in the low-risk category, but then they experience some significant stress, lose their house, or have a lot of financial difficulties, get divorced, then they may run into some problems and switch risk categories. Some of the questions that we'll talk about may be uncomfortable to ask, especially if you're meeting someone for the first time, but I always keep this quote in mind: he who asks is a fool for 5 minutes, but he or she who does not ask remains a fool forever. So it's better to know up front who or what you're putting the medication into than to deal with all the problems you might run into later. This was the risk stratification procedure we used. I can send you a copy of this. So we took all of the risk factors, and for a period, I think from maybe 2008 to 2012, we had either a psychologist or social worker who were seeing all of the new palliative patients and doing a pretty thorough assessment with them, not just to identify risk for opioid misuse, but to identify people who may be depressed or anxious so that we could get them the appropriate support they needed. So we were looking at pain medication risk, social risk, psychological, and different substance use history risk factors. The next step in the harm reduction model, we'll talk a little bit more at our next session, but monitoring aberrant behaviors. What are some of the aberrant behaviors that you would look for either in an inpatient or outpatient setting or have seen?
Requests for early bills.
Mm-hmm.
Drug screens with unprescribed medication or without the prescribed medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are two great ones. Anything else that you might look for?
Talking doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Going to different hospitals and for ERs if they get 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they start to visit the emergency department frequently. What else could be a trigger or sign for you to start paying more attention? I think we've only had like one or two instances of forged prescriptions. We've had people, family members or friends or not so friends, call in and express concern about pain medication use, but you have to be really careful with that because, say, people are going through a divorce or child custody battle and they're looking to get that person into trouble, which we've had a couple of times. Yeah, so we'll talk more about some different aberrant behaviors. Like the early refills probably falls on a more benign end of the spectrum, unless it occurs like as a pattern. You start to see that over time, whereas like forged prescriptions fall on the other end of the spectrum when you start to see that, you know, there's illegal behavior going on. So we have to be careful with aberrant behaviors. So I'll just say this, that 40 to 45% of the pain population will present with at least one aberrant behavior, usually running out of their prescription ahead of time. And it seldom denotes the presence of an addictive disease if you just have one behavior. So it's really the pattern that we're looking for. And this says like, so 40% with aberrant behaviors, 20% with abuse, and then 2 to 5% with addiction. So an abuse here just is misuse of the pain medication, sometimes for chemical coping. The next step, documenting and addressing aberrant behaviors when they happen. We'll talk some more next session about this too. So when you see a misuse behavior, that's more a question to be answered. So I think like, you may have been trained or seen providers that are like, oh, this happened and it's time to confront this. So I want you to try to keep an open mind when you see something happen, because you're really not going to get very far with a kind of a confrontational attitude with a patient that's running into problems with their opioids. So trying to keep an open mind and ask questions. So verify is accurate to the extent possible. We had one woman, I think she was maybe in her 70s, and based on the entire clinical interview, no aberrant behaviors whatsoever anything that would raise any flags. She had a urine drug screen, and it was positive for cocaine. And so we were all, oh, what? And so we were discussing, okay, how do we approach this? What, you know, how did this happen? How did we miss this? Like, there was no sign whatsoever on clinical interview that this was a risk. And then it turns out that with the company where we were using at the time to do the urine drug screens, they reran it, and it was not positive for cocaine, and the person before them had a positive screen, and they just hadn't cleaned their equipment. Well, so I was glad that we did due diligence, because at the time we were just trying to wean and discharge patients from clinics. So that would have been a very bad situation. Not that we haven't had 70-year-old women who have had problems with addiction. So that happens too, but not in this particular instance. So really try to avoid labeling. What I think strikes me is that whenever the word addiction gets in a patient's chart, especially in an electronic medical record, that goes everywhere in the hospital, and then everyone starts to see that patient from that perspective. So unless you know and that the person has been evaluated for an addiction by another professional, try to avoid that label as much as possible. But do describe the behaviors. You know, this is what we're seeing. The person's urine drug screens have been not clean for the past, like, six episodes. This is what we're concerned about and watching for. You've probably learned about the 4 A's, so documenting is what you're prescribing effective in terms of pain control? How's it impacting their functional status? Are there any adverse effects or side effects? And then are there any aberrant behaviors that you're noticing? And there's no legal obligation, at least in the state of Ohio, to always be right about addiction, but there is to seek professional advice and document. So if you suspect that somebody might have a problem with addiction, it's time to probably get a second opinion on that. And then aggressively treat comorbidities. And as you can see, there's potentially a lot of overlap. So if we have especially among cancer patients, 9 to 90% with cancer pain, and then 25 to 50% with a psychological disorder, and then 1 to 25% in the general population with substance use. We're going to have little pockets of overlap and a big pocket in the middle of overlap. So we try to treat all three simultaneously where we are able to, keeping in mind that the under-treatment of pain may lead to recurrence of drug-seeking behaviors in a recovering addicted person. So persons with addiction do have often a lower pain threshold, maybe from years of using different substances. The first 12 months of abstinence is the most vulnerable period, so keeping that in mind. So just because someone has been in a substance use treatment for 6 months or so, they're still not out of the woods in terms of their addiction. So they're someone that we really need to pay close attention to. Presence of psychiatric disorders increase the risk of relapse. So someone who's going for drug treatment but also has a problem with depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder will also need those things addressed. And then we all have to be aware of what our own pet diagnoses are. I think when I started, I would see everything through the lens of probably a psychological disorder. And I know that a lot of people in addiction programs are used to just seeing addiction. They're not used to seeing patients, cancer pain patients, who do quite well taking opioids and have no problems with that. They only see the other end of the spectrum, so they're more than likely going to see addiction there. And then the pain specialist, we have to watch out because everything becomes pain. So it's important to kind of have a perspective where it could be any or all of the above. So I'm going to talk briefly about a study that we did through the Center for Palliative Care. And again, this was data, I think, from 2010 to 2012 when we were doing an assessment with every patient. So we looked at 319 patients referred to palliative medicine, and they were assigned to those risk categories based on the risk stratification procedure into low, medium, or high. Most completed a UDT at their first visit and then regular intervals, where they were identified as moderate, low, moderate, or high risk. And then we used the harm reduction approach that we just covered, the model. These were the demographics, so it was pretty evenly distributed in terms of gender. Average age was 49, mostly Caucasian sample, 46% married, 39% had children. Living at home, average education 13 years, 62% were disabled by their medical condition, so they were no longer able to work due to cancer diagnosis or treatment, cancer-related pain, and about 14% of them were at risk for losing their home because they were no longer able to work. 93% had cancer, so at the time we were seeing a population of about 7% of other diagnoses like sickle cell disease or lung disease, I think were the most common. And so 44% had metastatic disease, but then 21% and 25% had local or remission. So these were the risk factors. I was really surprised by the percentage of people who actually had these risks. So 34% had an abuse history, so 23% had reported a history of emotional abuse, 20% physical abuse, and then 10% sexual abuse. 58% had a legal history. 32% had a history of arrest or incarceration, and then 25% had a history of DUIs, ranged anywhere from one. We had one person with 10 DUIs, so definitely fell in the high risk category, someone to watch. 7% reported theft, and 5% reported previous drug charges. And then 79% had a history of either a psychological diagnosis or suicide attempt, mostly depression, anxiety, but also some bipolar disorder. 40% had had some outpatient counseling, 3% had had an inpatient stay, and 72% were taking a prescription medication, usually an antidepressant. 18% had current suicidal ideation, so they came into clinic with that, and 10% had made a past suicide attempt. 58% had a history of heavy drug or alcohol use, and I think at the time, it's probably not true of our clinic today, but at the time it was, because I think a lot of oncologists were referring to our service just because they knew we had some psychology and social work staff. So I think the rate was probably higher at the time. 25% were using marijuana daily. 12% were using cocaine on a regular basis, so daily or weekly. 5% had abused heroin, and then 20% had a history of substance abuse treatment, 16% had current ongoing heavier drug or alcohol use, and 69% had previous cigarette smoking, and 37% were still smoking, which I think is higher than the average rate. I think it's like something like 25 or 30% now in the general population. What's important to note is of these 319 patients, 82% over the course of the study, so some, we studied them at the very least for 3 months, and at the longest, probably about 2 years. So 82% of those people had no significant aberrant behavior, so the majority of patients will do just fine taking their opioids longer term. But 18% had significant aberrant behaviors, and these were the what we saw. So 7% had illicit substance use or alcohol abuse, and then 3% had multiple providers. 3% had non-prescribed opioids or benzodiazepines and their UDTs. 3% were what we called a self-discharge, so they refused to provide urine or participate in a drug treatment program, so they ended up leaving the palliative service. 2% had urine drug screens negative for prescribed medications, or they weren't filling their medications. And then only 1% had multiple lost prescriptions or were forging their medications. So, one of the questions we ask is, how useful is this model in predicting a significant future aberrant behavior? So we were looking at low, moderate, and high risk, and does that predict whether they'll run into problems with their urine drug screens in the future, or whether they'll run into problems in terms of needing to discontinue them from opioids based on aberrant behavior? So we found that the model was very significant, especially looking between low and high-risk patients. The odds of a significant aberrant behavior was 14 times greater from the low to the high-risk category, and the odds of a significant aberrant behavior was 3 times greater from the low to the moderate group, moderate to low. We also wanted to know, from that whole list of risk factors that we were looking at to categorize patients as low, moderate, or high, which of those behaviors were most important? Because when you're in a busy clinic setting, you're not going to have time to do a very thorough risk factor assessment. You may not have a psychologist or a social worker in clinic to do that type of thorough assessment. So we were really wanting to know, if you had to boil it down to 5 or 6 different questions, what would you ask to know the your patient's risk level? So the final model was significant, and you could predict with, I think, 87% accuracy who was going to run into problems in the future just by asking these questions. So it included younger age, 18 to 45, male gender, job instability. And here, in terms of job instability, a lot of people living with cancer can no longer do their work. So this was more an assessment of what were they doing prior to their cancer diagnosis or treatment. Did they jump from job to job to job, where they only worked at a job for 4 or 5 months and then they moved on to something else? Or did they work continuously at, you know, an occupation for 10 years and then 5 years somewhere else? So so the greatest risk factors were job instability and having a history of theft. So if you could only ask your patients 2 questions, so those would be the 2 questions that I would definitely want to know before adding opioids to the mix. So these are the questions. What type of work have you done in the past? What's the longest you've worked at one place? Have you been diagnosed with any psychological disorder like depression or anxiety? And have you ever been diagnosed with or treated for bipolar disorder or ADHD or borderline personality disorder? If so, when and by whom? Have you ever tried or used cocaine? How long did you use cocaine and how often? So you're more looking for a person that's been using cocaine on a daily or weekly basis versus just someone who has tried cocaine once but then never used again. Do you currently smoke cigarettes, and have you had any legal difficulties? And you usually want to give them some context, so you're not just asking about theft, but such as bankruptcies, divorce, DUIs, been involved in theft, or been arrested or stayed in prison? If so, when and for what? So in summary, the harm reduction model provides a logical or balanced, compassionate approach to both pain treatment and drug abuse prevention, so you're not saying you're not going to prescribe opioids, you're just setting up a monitoring system to watch them over time. Not assuming that a high-risk patient will always abuse opioids or that a low-risk patient will never do so. And with aberrant behaviors, withholding judgment until an assessment has been performed. Our most potent weapon to protect our practice is prudent monitoring and meticulous documentation, which we'll spend some more time on in the next session, what to watch for and how to approach aberrant behaviors when they happen. And just keeping in mind all of those things at the bottom result in inappropriate treatment of pain. I like this quote too, so we're not setting out to solve the world's problems, but just paying attention where we can. Yeah, so at some time in your career, somebody's going to slip through the cracks in one way or another, and that doesn't mean you haven't done a good job with the majority of your patients. These are some different web resources, so I'll be sure to send this out to everyone. So this is usually, especially that if you haven't used the SAMHSA site, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, if you're looking for a drug treatment program for a psychiatrist and you don't have a social worker, someone available to help you to find something, that's the quickest way to go. You can look within state, within city, and identify the treatment programs and often what type of insurance they'll accept for those programs. These are some of the books I found really helpful, so definitely the Webster and Dove book. Check that one out. We'll talk about motivational interviewing, I think, coming up in as one of our future sessions, but that's a useful set of techniques when you have to address alcohol or drug abuse problems with your patients. And then Relapse Prevention, that's a great book by Marlette. And then these are some of the journals where you'll find articles about risk mitigation strategies. So Journal of Substance Abuse Treatment, Addiction Studies, Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, Journal of Palliative Medicine, Pain Medicine, and occasionally you'll find an article in JAMA about risk mitigation. And there's some additional references to some good articles, especially the one I mentioned about universal precautions and opioid trials. And I think that's it. Any thoughts, questions, concerns? Are you currently using that model in practice, or? Yeah, so you might be using pieces of it, just not have put together the model. Great. Okay, well, next time we'll be talking about monitoring aberrant behavior, so thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.